The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy, but we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. Thanks for tuning in. Let me run through the announcements real quickly so we can begin talking with Jim Muncy, who is our guest today. You can call us. Remember, this is a talk show, not an email show. That toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. If you do insist on using email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do remember also that we podcast. You can find the RSS URL on both of our newsletters and on our website. We use iTunes, Zoom by Microsoft, a host of other places. So you shouldn't have any trouble finding our podcast. If you have any questions, let me know about that. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website, or you can easily download those shows. And do remember, they're all copyrighted, and please don't do anything commercial. Don't edit them. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if it's for your own use. Visit our Space Show store on our website. Above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. We're only able to bring you this programming totally free, by the way, because many of you do donate to the Space Show, and that's how we're kept alive. So it is really important that we have your support. Remember, if you pay U.S. taxes, you get a deduction. And if you pay California taxes, you also get a deduction, as we're a California public benefit corporation. And then finally, the only other announcement I want to remind you all of is that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more info, do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And let me go directly to our guest today, and we're most fortunate to have Jim Muncy back with us. He's a co-founder of the Space Frontier Foundation. He's president and founder of Polyspace, which is an independent space policy consultancy. He has a very, very long track record of being right there in the heart of space policy inside the Beltway and also in the space enthusiast community. His full bio is up on the website in many, many places and will be again when I archive this program. So, Jim, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Hi, David. I have one major concern with one of your announcements. Does that mean I can't edit out the really bad things I say
about
on the website?
What,
I can't. Okay.
What bad things are you saying?
It was a joke.
Oh, I totally above my head.
That's okay.
I guess that's because the Giants are losing again, and I'm already pissed off for a Sunday.
And
losing to the worst team in baseball, Houston, which is like 33 games out of first place.
I think when I was a kid and I collected baseball cards, you know, getting Willie McCovey was one of my best days, you know. So I remember the Giants from the old days.
I would actually like the Buzz Aldrin baseball, so that kind of connects our space discussion to baseball, because he autographed a baseball or two back in the day, but I don't know where they are, and I probably couldn't afford them anyway. What's happening in space policy? Lots of things, I guess.
I every time I think it's gotten as crazy as it can possibly get here in Washington, when senators have said the stupidest things that I can imagine a senator saying, another member of the United States Senate proves me wrong and shows that they can be even more idiotic than the last. And I'm not picking any particular senator with this comment, but just it's this general trend of, no, we don't care if the rocket is too expensive. We don't care if we can't actually afford to do it. We don't care if it will take forever to actually develop the rocket and if we won't be able to actually explore, because if there's any hiccup in the NASA budget ever, we'll have to stop exploring again. You know, we just want you to start spending money on the rocket, you know, is just so pathetically, you know, craven and parochial. And in the case of some senators, not even effectively parochial, because they aren't even helping their own states. I'll pick one senator randomly, Senator Hutchison of Texas, okay? You know, she's been, you know, obviously a strong and powerful figure in advocating for the Space Launch System. But the interests of the Johnson Space Center are actually better served by investing in commercial crew so that the space station program that JSC runs is more successful, so that actually more scientists could go to the space station more frequently, so that a program that she fought for back in the 1990s and early 2000s, very aggressively, very patriotically, I think. You know, obviously it served her district, it served her state, but she honestly believed that the space station was critically important and the next, you know, part of human spaceflight. And she's not helping the space station by focusing all of her fire on the Space Launch System. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well,
and that's unfortunate.
If we want to be a devil's advocate here, and, you know, they're all, I'm sure, under a huge pressure vis-a-vis the economy that all of them have helped create and deliver to us, I would imagine their focus is on jobs. So to what degree do they really believe that this is the best way to protect and keep jobs in their state, especially coming up on elections?
I guess what they believe and whether or not it's rational for them to believe it are different things. I mean, it's entirely possible, for example, that Senator Nelson of Florida believes that the Space Launch System is good for Florida, okay? But it's not. It provides no benefit to Florida whatsoever. Basically, you're set in another situation, as we were in the 1970s, where the Kennedy Space Center is waiting for the Marshall Space Flight Center to develop something. And it would be okay if there hadn't been a lot of failed attempts by the Marshall Space Flight Center during the 1990s and 2000s to develop things that would then fly and operate from the Kennedy Space Center. I mean, that's sort of the division of responsibilities. Marshall is the rocket developer, the launch system developer, and KSC is the operator. Now, I don't accept that is the be-all and end-all of either of those two senators' reason for being. I think that Marshall has a lot of other things that it's very good at and is capable of doing, most especially propulsion research, as a springboard for new launch systems as opposed to just developing new launch systems as an integrated product. And the Kennedy Space Center has a lot to say about intelligent design based on the fact that they know how to operate things, and they know what isn't operable. So I don't think they should be put in their little, you know, round and square holes, with only the right, you know, color and the right shape of peg. But here we are once again with Kennedy waiting, you know, and Florida workforce waiting on Huntsville and other parts of the country to develop something that will then eventually, hopefully, start to fly from Florida. It's terrible for Florida. It basically puts them in a waiting game in a ghost town status until something comes out of Huntsville. And that's not an effective way to run a space program. I mean, assuming you want a federal space program, and I actually, you know, as a somewhat conservative Republican, I actually believe that we should have a federal space program. I think that there should actually be rockets that meet, you know, government requirements. They can still be done commercially, but they should meet, you know, government requirements that may go beyond what the commercial requirements are a little bit. And certainly I have no problem with there being a federal spaceship that goes out there and does exploration, at least initially. But, you know, to consign KSC to waiting forever, I mean, KSC benefits more than any other center from commercial crew, and JSC benefits from commercial crew. But it's been Senator Nelson from Florida and Senator Hutchison from Texas that have been the strongest advocates of interest in Utah and Alabama and elsewhere rather than the interests of their own states. So go figure. I mean, maybe they're trying to be national and they're trying to be, you know, on behalf of the whole space program, and they believe that you need the whole, if I may borrow a term, a constellation of contractors working together across the country in order to have a politically unified and politically effective team. Maybe. But that doesn't mean it's actually going to get us into space. And I'm really worried that we continue to fixate on things that have nothing to do with get us into space, but have everything to do with spending money in certain states.
So where are we as of this show? What is actually happening? And I don't know, are you able to talk any about this? Is it a real move to go to the FAR and dump the Space Act agreement, or are they hybriding it like a Honda, a Toyota Prius? Or, what's the status on that, too?
Well, I think this, you're speaking now about commercial crew and NASA's desire to change the acquisition partnership instrument from the federal, from other transactions authority or Space Act agreements to the federal acquisition rules. And there's a lot of reasons why NASA is doing that, and I think it's a terrible idea. And unfortunately, I think it's, in a lot of ways, I don't think we've done a very good job of fighting the fight and explaining why it's just a non-starter to do this. But NASA seems to have made up its mind. And it's, you know, it may be that, you know, that fight is lost already. I think it's certainly worthwhile to continue to point out what the drawbacks are and what the risks are with going with this approach. But NASA, for a host of reasons, some of which you'll be certainly shocked to know are more institutional and cultural than economic or technical or managerial.
Oh, I can't believe that would be the case, Jim.
We are headed down this road now, and ultimately the companies have to decide whether or not it's better for them to have a program that starts in X months or X plus 2 or 3 months. And they'll probably choose with the program that starts sooner, even if it has more risk associated with it, because everyone's driven, you know, by resources. I'm hoping that it will be possible to use a part of the federal acquisition rules, which are called FAR Part 12 or commercial procurements, to do this, so that at least we don't have to be burdened by the worst parts of the FAR overall. And there's all sorts of parts, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons that are stated as to why it's a bad idea to use the FAR. But all of it's basically, I don't want to say it's nonsense, but what it really boils down to is, does NASA get to tell the contractors to change their design because NASA wants them to change their design? And they get to tell them to change the design without convincing them, without negotiating with them, without discussing it and convincing them that it really is technically better and better in terms of safety and things like that. Or can NASA just sort of, you know, as on its own, decide, we don't like this design, we want to change it, therefore you will change it, which is, of course, what they do on regular cost-plus programs all the time. And, you know, there was a really good piece, I'm trying to remember where I saw it just recently, might have been an Aviation Week, but it quoted John Elbon from Boeing, in which it talked is who ultimately has design control, who ultimately can decide, you know, how they're going to design the vehicle. And if the government can, see, the government can, under a Space Act agreement, the government can persuade, it can negotiate, it can ask for all sorts of changes in the design. It can say, we would be more comfortable if you did it this way. We would be more comfortable if this particular system had a double redundancy or a triple redundancy, or if you used this approach instead of that approach. All right? But they have to convince you. It's a negotiation. They can't just impose it on the contractor. And that's generally a good thing because it's the company, the commercial partner, is motivated to try to satisfy the customer. Because after all, you know, the initial anchor tenant for these vehicles and these systems will be NASA. So it's not like they don't want to try, if they can, meet reasonable requests on the part of a customer. I mean, these companies are commercial companies. They are trying to satisfy what the customer wants. But the problem is that if NASA gets to just impose it unilaterally without any discussion or without negotiation, then you could be in a situation where, you know, there's no, not only is there no compensation if the change turns out to be bad from a commercial point of view, but, you know, you're really not in charge of your own vehicle anymore. And at that point, it's not really a commercial system anymore because your priorities as a commercial developer aren't being taken into account in how it's designed and how it's going to be operated. And you can't, I mean, commercial isn't magic. You know, people talk about, well, new space versus old space and all that sort of stuff. All right, that's, you know, I am less into the nomenclature and the labels, you know, than perhaps than some people are. And, you know, it's not about which company it is. Boeing has parts of it that are very much new space in the sense that they are committed to doing things in a more entrepreneurial, more decentralized, more light, i.e. not throwing thousands of people at a project, you know, that are very much, you know, like parts of X-Corps, okay? United Launch Alliance is very similar, okay? They have, in parts of the United Launch Alliance are, you know, absolutely, they salute the Air Force and they do things exactly the way the Air Force wants done. And there are parts of the Launch Alliance that, you know, while they still understand the Air Force's customer, they're very entrepreneurial in how they go about things. So it's not that, you know, companies are commercial or aren't commercial or are new space or aren't new space. It all depends on the project. It all depends on what you're asking them to do. And the problem is that if NASA goes off in the direction they seem to be going off in, they're going to be telling Boeing and Sierra Nevada and SpaceX and any of the other companies that will be involved in commercial crew, ultimately this is going to be like old space. Ultimately this is going to be like how we do everything else. And then if you look at the, you know, the cost assessment that was done of SpaceX's development of the Falcon 9, including all the work done on the Falcon 1, you know, the reason why it was between 10 and 5 times, a factor of 10 and a factor of 5 times less than the NASA Air Force cost model said it would be to develop that kind of hardware is not because SpaceX is not Boeing or SpaceX is not Lockheed, okay? It's because Boeing and Lockheed, in how they do work for the federal government, are typically a mirror image of the federal government. And SpaceX, because they're in a commercial business of developing launch vehicles that they want to sell in the commercial marketplace, starts everything from the point of view, from the perspective of how do I do this as cheaply as possible, because, and how do I do it to be as quick and responsive as possible, because time is money, and all sorts of things that are free costs in the government world are not free costs in the commercial world. And so all sorts of design choices are made by a SpaceX operating commercially differently than a Lockheed or Boeing when operating under contract to the federal government. And it's not that Boeing and Lockheed are stupid or Boeing and Lockheed are different kinds of people. I mean, there's no question that different kinds of people go and work on companies that can operate on a commercial basis than go and work for the government, typically. You know, you have to have a higher tolerance for frustration if you go to work for a Boeing or a Lockheed working for NASA, because you guys will be the ones intimately working with the hardware and building the hardware and testing out ideas, and the government will say, yeah, but I want you to do it this way. And you have to be, you know, there's going to be frustrations when you don't agree with the government in their design choice, but you got to do what they want because they're telling you how to design it and how to build it.
So in theory, for example, under the traditional FAR, NASA could mandate SpaceX do X, Y, and Z with the Dragon, and NASA would end up paying for that and the cost delays, and the cost would drive up, and that may or may not be an effective way to do whatever it is they're doing on the Dragon.
Well, it could. I mean, I guess the whole problem with it is that you could totally ruin Dragon as a commercial system. I'm not going to try to pick a specific example, but I'm sure, you know, most of your listeners, you know, with technical expertise would say, I'll try to come up with an example. If NASA says, you know, the upper stage you use just really doesn't give it enough kick because we want you to go ahead and go to a hydrogen stage now. Well, obviously SpaceX wants to go to a hydrogen upper stage at some point and has designs they've been working on, et cetera. But if NASA decides for a technical reason or some other reason that NASA has because of its own institutional biases, makes a decision that incurs costs for SpaceX, that tells SpaceX they have to go spend money that they weren't planning to spend in the time frame that they were planning to spend it, and they raise costs for SpaceX, and therefore SpaceX has to reflect those in their prices, or else they're not a sustainable business, you know, you could see the destruction of potential demand because the prices go up. So you could see less of a revolutionary impact on the space transportation economy because SpaceX isn't able to price as competitively as they could otherwise. That's a really bad outcome. Now, there's no way the federal government is going to compensate SpaceX for that lost revenue. At most, all they'll do is compensate them for some part of the initial upfront cost. But under a fixed price FAR-based contract, even that wouldn't be recovered. But ultimately, the question is who's in control. And so all of this, I believe, is a smokescreen for the fundamental issue of who's in control. Does NASA believe that they can work with companies that are, in some cases, the same companies they worked with on the shuttle, the same companies they worked with on Apollo, okay, the same companies that they worked with on Space Station, and say, okay, you guys have built up a lot of expertise in your company. We still have a lot of expertise inside NASA. We're going to be partners, and we're going to negotiate these things. We're going to discuss these things, and we're going to come to the best possible system that we can agree on together. Or is the government going to say, no, I don't trust you, because ultimately you're just a contractor. You're not getting paid what a contractor does, because commercial partners are much cheaper than standard contract arrangements. But we have to be able to tell you how to design the vehicle because we really only trust ourselves, ultimately. Well, you know, NASA's safety record is not without blemishes. And I think it's crazy to say that only government can be trusted to decide whether or not a system's going to be safe or not. But that's where we are. And, you know, either NASA is going to believe that industry can produce reliable hardware that is as safe as we can make space hardware like it and still fly it and actually, you know, launch. You know, it's really safe if you never launch, if you always stay in the paper design phase. PowerPoint is incredibly safe. You know, the only only people who ever died from PowerPoint got paper cuts. You know, or carpal, really bad carpal tunnel or something. But, you know, it's not the same thing.
Here's a question for you from Randy. And again, listeners, the phone number to use rather than to keep using email all the time, 866-687-7223. So Randy's in St. Louis, and he says, I think the fundamental issue is a lot broader and far different than just space. While many of us think Congress really is inept, they can't be so dumb and so inept not to know their track record for having spent billions and billions on failed, canceled aviation as well as space projects. They also know that the focus right now is on the budget and on the economy, and they're moving into an election year, and that focus is not going to change, especially given the dismal economic performance of the United States and what's happening with European banks and other markets. So how in the hell can they in any way whatsoever support programs that they know from the track record are going to drive up costs substantially and delay projects and likely lead to their cancellation, just the same as Constellation, where they wasted, I don't know, $12 billion, $13, $14 billion of taxpayer money when they ultimately ended up canceling it? And if we have another president come in, what programs is the other president going to cancel, and how much is that going to cost? So why in the world, in this environment, would they opt for programming that they know from past history is going to drive costs through the roof? It would seem to me that if they really want a space program, their only path of least resistance and the most rational thing they can do is to opt for a low-cost way of doing things, and that would be to give the commercial markets a real bona fide chance at proving that they can take over low-Earth orbit, at least that level of space, leaving other parts of space possibly still for government programs. Any comments on this? This defies logic, and I can't imagine Congress is that stupid, but maybe they are.
I was born in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, our sympathies, right.
And so, well, no, what that means is I didn't come here for the power trip. I didn't come here to be part of government, okay?
Yeah.
I was born here. I just ended up, you know, I was here to start with. And I'm going to say something that may be a little controversial to your listeners, and that is that I actually believe that what we call politics in Washington, D.C. is actually how a free society manages itself. And it is incredibly messy, and it is an incredibly ugly, okay? And it's not just, you know, like Churchill's famous quote about it being the worst possible system except for all the others. You know, it really is. I mean, how would you do it that didn't require knowing what was in the heart of a person and somehow believing that a person could be anointed with power to make wise and just decisions? Okay? Unless you believe in magic, okay, it has to be a debate. It has to be an ongoing process. Now, I believe that most members of the Senate and most members of the House of Representatives are, in fact, extremely rational. They're just basing their decisions on assumptions and values and data points that we aren't using. So when your listener says, when Randy says accurately that there are countless demonstrations of the failure of NASA and other large organizations to develop things that cost what they say they're going to cost and are, you know, start working on the schedule that they're supposed to start working, you know, that is the triumph of hope over experience. You know, and hope is not a strategy. But politicians engage in it willy-nilly because it's easier for them to believe that what their constituents or what their friends in industry or whoever is telling them could work out, you know, than to believe that the whole fundamental system is dysfunctional, that the whole program, the whole architecture of how we do space in this country, how we do large aerospace, particularly in the civil sphere, you know, for them to confront the fact that it's broken. They don't want to confront that. It's hard. It requires thought. It requires effort. It requires political capital if you want to fix it. You have to take money away from people who currently have money and therefore will fight to stop you in order to reform the situation. I mean, let me pick on, you know, some folks that I think are great people who are patriots and absolutely believe in what they're doing, okay? And that's the folks that at ATK in Utah, okay?
Okay.
They build solid rocket motors that go into ICBMs that have, whether or not you like deterrence or not, and I don't happen to like deterrence as a national strategy, but whatever you think of it, have maintained the peace for the last 60 years. Okay? Various, you know, predecessor companies to ATK, now in ATK, they have helped defend America. They are patriots. They are good people. They build solid rockets, and the solid rockets actually work. When you don't design them with silly field joints, and you don't make them operate when they're not supposed to be operated, they work. Okay? The problem is, they're expensive. They have certain performance advantages, and they have certain performance disadvantages. And most rocket scientists, independent rocket scientists, given a choice, would rather not work with solids for many applications, and certainly for most applications involving human beings. Now, the fact is that Richard Nixon didn't give NASA enough money to develop the shuttle. Given what they had to do, they chose solids. They chose segmented solids, which at the time were used on Titan launch vehicles and other launch vehicles back in the 1970s. But no one else uses segmented solids anymore. Okay? But the only U.S. user of them is NASA. What that means economically, and this has nothing to say about their technology or the people or anything, but economically it means that NASA has to pay for all of the infrastructure costs of making segmented solids. Now, if you had a choice between using segmented solids and using a different technology that also already exists, that is already used by not just one user, but multiple users, okay, that was, you know, as good or better, depending on, you know, what your priorities are, than segmented solids, you would probably choose, you know, apples to apples, to go with a system where you didn't have to pay all of the fixed costs yourself, because you would rather spend money. I mean, ultimately, if you know, the Augustine Report is all about fixed cost versus variable cost. The Heft study, the independent cost analysis that's going on right now, that was just completed for the Space Launch System. All of this whole thing about human exploration, where we're going, is all about fixed costs and variable costs. Ultimately, you want more of your money to be spent on variable costs than fixed costs, because that means you're actually flying. You're actually exploring. You're actually doing something and not just maintaining your fixed infrastructure.
You have a caller. Let's go take your caller. Hi, caller. Are you on, please?
Yes.
And you are?
This is John, Atlanta.
Go for it, John.
Well, okay, first on the Congress issue, I think the key thing there is partly just authority. I mean, Congress passed a law and said, we want you to do this. We appropriated money to do this. And if the administration isn't doing this, that is a direct attack on their constitutional authority, and I think that's why they're taking the position they are. I mean, simply, and the other issue is why they passed the law in the first place, another issue, but that's, I think, a key point.
So what are they supposed to do, Jim? Because while I am a total firm believer in heavy lift, and I differ with the caller on this, I think this is a heavy lift to nowhere. I'd bet you anything after they spend $8, $9, $10 billion on it and suck NASA dry with it, they'll cancel the damn program with nothing built. That's I absolutely firmly believe that, and I am
a
big.
By the way, if that happens, if that is what happens, it won't be because the design wasn't the perfect design. Okay, it'll be because it cost too much to develop. Or it looked like it would cost too much to operate, and therefore, ultimately, we wouldn't be able to actually explore with it. And since the purpose is eventually exploration, not just keeping certain contractors under contract, you know, we have to be able to actually go use the systems to do actual space stuff. Now, John, if I were in charge, which I'm not, and I'm sure a lot of people are sighing very, very peacefully now to know that I'm not in charge. You know, I would not have supported the legislation, first and foremost. But secondly, I would say, okay, the law says that we will do these things to the extent practicable. If it turns out that budgets aren't going to allow for us to do it this way, and you want there to be a heavy lift launch system, but it needs to be cheaper than doing it the way you have recommended, then we're going to take a different course. I'll give you a very simple example that's a major issue right now, sort of in the belly of the beast, okay? There's a debate going on between whether or not, from between some senators and other senators, over whether or not we should compete. What kind of booster is on the side of the SLS? Should we use the five segments that are just about through development from Aries 1 and work on for SLS, or should we use some sort of liquid booster? Now, the argument is made. We already have the solids, so there's no risk associated with using those solids. Let's compete later. Let's use solids for the first few flights. And then we'll have a competition, and Aerojet and whoever they're working with, and SpaceX and ULA and others can compete against each other to develop a new liquid booster that will be the booster for SLS going forward. There's lots of things that are wrong with that and are bad ideas with that. But the fact is there are existing liquid rockets that will work to meet the real needs of SLS early on. Now, notice, I'm not questioning the need for an SLS right now. I'm not questioning the fundamental design of the SLS. I'm simply asking, could you save money by using Atlas V Common Core boosters or Falcon 9, you know, first stages as strap-on liquids right now instead of solids? And the answer is, you would save hundreds of millions a year in fixed costs. Now, if you saved hundreds of millions a year in fixed costs and you could plow that money back into the rest of SLS, whether it's the upper stage or the first stage, core stage, or whatever, then you could actually develop the SLS faster and the total cost would go down because you were developing it faster. And we would actually perhaps be able to launch Orion with people on it, on SLS, before 2021. And it would be complete in its development long before 2031. Now, I'm not arguing that this is the perfect option for exploration. I'm simply saying there's one example where you have politicians fighting over jobs in their state, okay? And most recently, you know, the majority leader and Senator Hatch and the other senator from Nevada and two senators from Idaho write a letter to NASA and the White House saying, you must use solids. According to what? The law doesn't say you have to use solids.
Well, I'd agree with
that. In fact, the law says that you have to do whatever is practicable. Well, if it turns out that SLS can be developed faster, cheaper, and operate more frequently if you don't use solids than if you do, why wouldn't you do that? And if ultimately you're making the decision based on which politicians are yelling at you the most, then it's not about are you honoring the legislation or not. It's about whether or not you're honoring particular parochial interests.
Yeah, but, I mean, I don't think there's any issue at this point, seriously, that NASA is saying, okay, we've got this other design using Falcon 9 core stages, and we're not going to use the solids, and that's the problem. It's, I think it's that they're just basically stalling the whole program, if I understand it. It's not that they have an ulterior design. That certainly senators want their own companies to have the contract, but I don't think that's what's really stalling the problem right now, is it?
Well, one of the issues that is stalling, is causing problems right now on the schedule, is the fact that there are parts of NASA that want to embrace competition from the very beginning, and there are parts of NASA that don't.
Well, competition makes no sense. If we already have the solid almost developed, why don't we just use it? It seems to me...
If it turns out that it's more expensive than we can afford, then it's dumb to use it.
The other thing, of course, is that as far as the long-term picture, I mean, I think it's almost certain that any big heavy lift booster we start now, program is going to, at best, get stretched out of a lengthy period of time. And I would use the example of what happened with the C-17 aircraft program in the 80s, where because of political reasons, a decision was made to make 50 additional C-5Bs, and they basically just stretched the program out for years until the 90s when they finally started making C-17s. I think the same thing is going to probably happen to this at best if it doesn't get canceled. But it gets you, at least you have a program that's underway and people are working on it. I mean, it keeps the talent pool employed, which I think is important. It keeps us, and there's a chance that the economy ever gets straightened out in several years from now, maybe we would have money to really do it.
I want to strongly agree with your argument about using the talent pool. There's a difference, there's an argument that's made by a lot of folks in these debates about, the importance of the industrial base and, we have to save this base or we have to save that part of the base or whatever. Most of that is parochial talk, okay, and doesn't make any sense from my point of view because it makes the assumption that you always want to have the same industrial base as you've had in the past, and that's not true, or at least that's a fallacy assumption. But you do want to have talented people who are working in the program to have something to do, assuming you're going to ever have a program again. You have to give them some opportunity to make a contribution somewhere. And I completely agree with that. And again, if I were in charge, I would have stood up and said, there's a different way to accomplish the fundamental goals of the act. I would have either wanted to change the act, or I would want to show the Senate that there are different ways of implementing what's in the act and achieving what I would argue are the fundamental goals of the act. And in that way, you wouldn't be fighting with the Senate over the whole idea of do you respect the law or not, which I would agree with John is sort of where we are right now. I would not say right now, with all due respect to General Bolden, that NASA has its most politically effective leadership right today. Okay?
Ineffective.
I think Charlie is a great man and was certainly a great astronaut and probably a great general. But he's not a master politician, okay? And ultimately, that's a big part of this job. We frankly need to have someone in the job who's going to say, I understand where you're coming from, but I can't do this for you. I can do these things for you. I can't do this for you. And, here's an alternative path that gets you most of what you want. And then they either agree or they don't, and you have a fight about it. I don't think Charlie's, and I think this is partly due to, you know, the people that work for NASA, sort of the permanent bureaucracy of NASA. They haven't want to look for creative ways of getting around some of these problems. And that's put Charlie in a bad situation. And it looks like we have this huge tug of war, you know, where we're trying to decide where are we going. Ultimately, dollars will tell us what we get to do and where we get to go. And ultimately, I think the dollars are going to tell us that we won't get to go there exactly the way the Senate told us to in the Authorization Act. And that's going to cause a lot of yelling and screaming and kvetching, and hopefully we'll get through it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I think you have to say is that the genesis of the Senate bill that eventually got passed was the original NASA decision, or administration decision, probably more of the point, to basically with the shuttle retiring, cancel all of Constellation in total, and just sort of talk about maybe we might start a heavy lift vehicle in 5 years and so forth. I think this is a big pushback to that primarily.
Oh, absolutely. I happen to be aware of probably more details than a Republican lobbyist should be aware of the inner workings of the Obama administration in that decision process. And I can't talk about them in great detail, but let us just say that was not an optimum announcement or an optimum presentation of what was really the plan. There was a plan that arose out of Augustine and the recommendations of Augustine that most people were behind. And there were parts of NASA that could not give up the idea that they were going to have Constellation and that they were going to be given an extra $3 billion plus a year in order to do Constellation plus other things that needed to be done, like technology development. And those people, you know, sort of like tried to get Constellation as well as what was being offered. And they almost got nothing. I mean, we almost saw, you know, there's been a lot of fairly loose talk over the last year and a half saying that President Obama personally wanted to end NASA's human spaceflight program, or that Lori Garver or Charlie Bolden or OSTP or John Holdren, the science advisor, or whatever, you know, personally wanted to get rid of NASA's human spaceflight program because liberal Democrats don't like human spaceflight or other things, okay?
I tend to agree with at least the Holden and possibly Obama part.
Okay, well, I understand that, and it is entirely possible, okay? I've never met the president or talked to the president. I was once in the same room as the president, and that was at the Kennedy speech in April of last year. And I don't expect to ever be in the same room as the president again, because I'm not a fan of the president. But I don't think he gives a damn about human spaceflight one way or the other. I honestly think that the reason he's willing to try capitalism in space, whereas he isn't willing to try capitalism in, say, for example, healthcare, is because he doesn't care about it. You know, he doesn't want to spend a lot of money on it because he doesn't have a lot of extra money that he can spend. I mean, nobody ever does, but.
Right.
Certainly in his situation where he's got...
They did, because they were spending all kinds of stimulus money. Why couldn't they throw in a few more billion in space? I mean,
because
spending, so why not do that?
For a bunch of reasons, which you may or may not agree with, John,
Yeah. They
didn't believe that spending more money on NASA and the standard NASA program would really be that stimulative of the economy. And, frankly, I have to say that there's an argument for that.
I'm getting into politics here, but I mean, considering what they did spend a lot of it on, I mean,
I'm not going to disagree with you because I don't agree with the president's policies, but
right.
my honest assessment is that, you know, he doesn't hate human spaceflight, he doesn't care about it,
right.
and the reality is that. They are perfectly willing to spend money on NASA if it isn't going to cost a lot of money, and most importantly, isn't going to cause a lot of controversy or require political capital to be spent by the president in an area, as I say, he doesn't really care about. So what we've had then is we've had a program that largely has been managed by the senior senator from Florida, you know, who has said, I don't want an Air Force general to be the NASA administrator. I have someone I want to be the NASA administrator, so I'm not going to let you appoint this Air Force guy. Oh, you want to appoint someone who has all this experience at a management level inside NASA and the experience of working in OMB. Oh, no, I'm not going to let you appoint that person NASA administrator. I want you to appoint my person as NASA administrator. And we have Charlie Bolden because Bill Nelson wanted him to be NASA administrator. Now, you know, I think the world of Charlie, but again, we have what we have because, you know, the administration was not willing to go to bat for some of their ideas, and just because Nelson wanted something else. That's the reason we have the authorization bill. I mean, on the Tuesday after the authorization bill was introduced, you know, NASA was ginned up to attack the authorization bill as unsustainable. I know that for a fact. Mm-hmm. And that night, NASA was told to go silent and to stop criticizing the authorization bill. And the reason they did that is because Bill Nelson called the White House and said, I'm trying to save the president's policy, and if you don't have this, you won't have anything, and therefore, we got the authorization bill. I mean, that's just a fact. That's how it happened. And, you know, I would not have agreed with the authorization bill. I mean, I had problems with it at the time. There were things about it that were better than nothing, and so, like many people, I supported it tacitly. But, you know, it was not, you know, I supported it in part because it said things like, well, we're going to do this, but we're going to do this to the extent that it's practical to do it. And if it's not practical to have a shuttle-derived heavy lift launch system as the long pole in the tent for humans going beyond low Earth orbit, then we shouldn't make it that way. I mean, Lockheed, if you go to Lockheed's website, if you search for stepping stones, if you just do a Google search for Lockheed Martin, Orion, and then the word stepping stones, you will find a brochure online that Lockheed has that shows 4 years of exploration missions that Orion can do before the heavy lift is ready to start flying crewed flights.
Subject of next Sunday's space show, by the way, with Josh Hopkins of Lockheed.
Okay, and so, well, that's perfect because it shows that you don't have to have heavy lift to get started exploring. Now,
well, I'd agree with that.
The reason, but the reason why NASA hasn't been willing to talk about that is because they have believed, for whatever reason, that if you didn't have the pressure of no exploration until heavy lift to get heavy lift funded and to get heavy lift underway, you would never get it. And so the whole structure of the authorization bill, the whole structure of the deal, the whole structure of the conversation that, you know, we've been having for months now has been, well, we may not need it right away, but we have to have it eventually. Therefore, we should use the technologies that we have now. We shouldn't try to develop any new technologies. We should use the technologies we have now and the approaches we have now to go develop a system, even if it's more expensive than we could afford to ever fly. Now, I'm more pro-space than that. I am more committed to actually having a United States human spaceflight program that is run by the government on behalf of taxpayers, that is not a purely commercial enterprise, that and therefore will say, I'm sorry, that's not good enough. That just isn't good enough to put us in thrall to the industry that currently has contracts because they're part of the shuttle program and would like to have contracts so that, you know, they can be part of the next heavy lift system. I'm sorry. It's just not good enough to me that we're stuck like this, basically keeping certain companies under contract because they want to be. Well, life's rough. You know, we can't all do everything we want to do the way we want to do it when we want to do it. You know, maybe I would have liked to marry Gillian Anderson, but, you know, Gillian Anderson, one, she's a socialist, and two, she probably wouldn't be interested in me. So, you know, there we are.
And
Ann
Coulter's dating a lefty, so, you know, strange things happen.
And my wife would argue she's dating a lefty, too. So, you know, there you go.
Listen, we got to take a break, and John,
yeah,
John,
I really appreciate your question. That was really great. It really got us into a lot of good meat.
Yeah, John, I got to clear the line for others, okay?
Okay.
Thanks. Listeners, we're going to break, but the toll-free line is available, and if you want to use it, we do take the calls in during the break. 1-866-687-7223. Stay right where you are. Back with more from Jim Muncy in about 2.5 minutes or so.
This is with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a space-faring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. And our Sunday show guest is Jim Muncy. We're talking space policy and everything in between. And caller Tim from Huntsville is on the line. Tim, are you there? I guess he hung up. Tim, call back. I don't know what happened. We lost you on the phone line. And while we're waiting for Tim to call back, the 1-866-687-7223 number is there. I have a couple of emails that Tim has sent in. What did he do? Okay, he's having phone line problems again, Jim. So he's got a phone issue there in Huntsville. Okay, here's his first email question. We'll do it this way. From Tim in Huntsville. Some of the Space Show listeners have stated that if SpaceX takes government money and works with the government, they may be assimilated into the NASA culture and be like Boeing and Lockheed, a microcosm of NASA. Is this something you believe, and why would you hold your view on the subject?
I'm
sure you've heard that
question.
Yeah, I'm sure you've heard it before.
I've heard the argument before. Listen, any customer-focused organization or institution will, to the extent it decides to accept the terms and conditions under which a customer wants to buy something, will adapt itself and become more like the customer. If the government is unwilling to do business in a arm's-length commercial transaction where, it is willing to, you know, perhaps be a launch customer for a new capability, but not take all the financial risk and not take all of the a burden of being a long-term customer for all of the capabilities of the commercial provider. so that there is a motivation to go seek commercial customers in the private market. If the government's not willing to do that for whatever reason, then companies like SpaceX are going to have to exist on the private market, and whatever limited transactions they can engage in with the government customer that doesn't fundamentally change their character. Because I think most companies know that if they go in a certain direction, that road doesn't necessarily have a good ending. Now, I'm not speaking for SpaceX, obviously, and I would argue that there are parts of the government. I mean, the Defense Department currently buys the lion's share of its imagery from satellites that soldiers use to go fight wars with from private companies on a commercial basis. Now, if the Defense Department can do that, I would think that NASA could learn to buy launches of astronauts to low Earth orbit in a more commercial fashion. It's almost a religious thing for some people in NASA. That they just, that it's human spaceflight. It's different. Okay? And yes, it's different. The payload is a very politically sensitive customer. And I'm not saying that to be at all disrespectful to the astronaut corps or anyone, because I have the highest respect for NASA's astronauts. But the fact is that they are people. They are, and obviously no launch company wants to risk its customers' lives, whether you're in the suborbital tourism business or in the orbital astronaut launching business for ISS. But to say that you have to do things exactly the way we've always done them in human spaceflight forever because that's how we have to do it, that's not an argument from ration or data or reason. That's just an argument from religion and from, something else. And it's not going to get us into space.
You got a caller on hold. Let's jump to that. Hi, caller. Are you there, please?
Yeah, hello. This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall in Dallas for you, Jim.
Hey. I have a little different tack that brings up, you were talking about the different congressmen and senators that come in and are making decisions and they want these people here and so on. I have a lot of friends that are like Tea Partiers, and they're talking about a big, huge budget-cutting axe. And coming up the next election, there's probably going to be a lot of people replaced. That brings up the question of who's really making the decisions? Is it like three or four key people, or is it a consensus of a rather large committee, or, does it really actually go out and get approved by, all the senators and representatives?
Great question. That's a great question. Very often, like almost any political decision in Washington that is not what I would call sort of a first-tier political issue, like healthcare, okay, healthcare clearly touches the lives of every single constituent that a member of Congress has. So every member of Congress is going to spend a lot of time thinking about how their vote on a healthcare issue, affects their constituents and affects the economy and all these sorts of other things. The reality is that for space, not as many members of Congress are going to get personally involved in the decision. However, what that means is that citizens like yourself can have more of an impact if they can get their member of Congress to play a role in space policy. Because there are not that many members actually playing an active role. Probably because there aren't that many constituencies that are seen to be, where space is a really important issue for them. So, in a sense, that gives us an opportunity, those of us who want to change space policy, who want to try to make space more commercial, more economically beneficial to the country, There's an opportunity for us to try to work with citizens around the country to try to make change, and we can do that, and we can have an impact out of proportion to our numbers, simply because there aren't as many congressmen currently thinking about space. Now, the bad side is that, you know, there aren't that many congressmen thinking about space, and you can get decisions that are made by a few members of Congress that aren't very good. And I would argue, you know, to some extent, the NASA Authorization Act did a good job of knitting together the 20 or so senators that really cared about space in last year's Senate debate over the direction of our space program, but it did a pretty lousy job of actually knitting together a plan for our long-term space program. And at the time, a lot of us said, you know, don't they know? Don't they understand that what they're doing isn't going to work? And it worked at accomplishing what they wanted to accomplish, which was to actually unify the disparate political elements behind a plan, any plan. And they did that. And, of course, right now what we're dealing with is the fact that we can't really afford to do what it is they really wanted NASA to do.
Exactly. Here's another little twist on the same line of logic. I think there's going to be major budget cuts. Well, there will be budget cuts in the future, but the portion of it that falls to NASA is going to take out a lot of projects. Constellation and the James Webb Telescope already been, I think both of them have been totally axed.
Well, Constellation is dead. And has been replaced with the, you know, the new authorization compromise. Some people like to call it Constellation Light. In the House of Representatives, the Appropriation Committee has proposed axing James Webb. The Senate hasn't spoken yet, and of course we'll probably have a continuing resolution again this year. But there's no question that it's not just human spaceflight that has problems with its programs. Space science can have problems as well, and that's the issue that they're confronting right now at the Goddard Space Flight Center.
Exactly. The real fun issue to kind of get the space cadets out there and working is we need to also worry about funding for Hubble, the Mars rovers, Dawn, New Horizons, all these planetary exploration systems that are already out there. Sending back data, last thing we want is to have those already expensive systems out there collecting data and sending it to us, and then just collect the data and let it sit in the computers.
That's when I got into the space field in the early 1980s, one of the big problems that NASA had was that they had ongoing science missions, and because, you know, generally speaking, NASA hardware, you know, when it works, it really works very well, okay? And the science missions in particular, you know, some would argue that they're over-designed, but never mind that. The point is that a lot of our science missions last a lot longer than they're supposed to last. And that creates an opportunity to go on and collect more data. The problem is that then you have to pay for keeping the science teams around to collect that data and do more and effectively do more science. Now, it's obviously a great opportunity in that you don't have to pay for another mission. You're basically just paying to continue to have the same team collecting more data, and that's a great opportunity.
You don't even have to pay them to learn to do it. They're already trained.
Exactly. I'm totally with you. The problem is right now on James Webb, even. The amount of funding that's available to NASA's astrophysics program is so little because of the cost impact of James Webb that there's actual concern that they may have to start shutting down existing missions that are working and actually discovering things. And that's a real concern because then you're not just shutting down, you know, you're not just canceling new projects that might get started, which is something that's happening because of James Webb, but you're also shutting down existing projects that are already working because it's more important to go have this one very large project. You know, and by the way, James Webb reminds me, you may find this interesting, David, James Webb reminds me, the whole this conversation that people are having about James Webb reminds me of the 1990s and the space station, the early 1990s decisions on the space station, when there were real concerns about space station freedom and how much it was costing and how long it was going to take to build and how it, you know, it seemed like, oh, well, if we don't have space station freedom, we don't have a human spaceflight program anymore, you know, which may or may not sound a little bit like recent discussions about Constellation. And the result was, is of course, we did have a space station, but it didn't look anything like what we were talking about before because we brought the Russians into the partnership. And, you know, whether or not you think that was a good idea, and that's not my point here, the point is the program became very changed, very different, by bringing the Russians in, but we did have a program. And the program was changed from what it was.
It all turned on one vote.
Exactly. And we may very well see a change to James Webb to cut it back dramatically, or bring in new partners or do something else that will relieve the financial pressure. Because right now what James Webb is doing is basically blinding the rest of our astrophysics program because we can't afford any other mission.
Yeah.
Well, unless they decided to fund it adequately, but they're not going to do that.
But how do you fund it adequately, David? I mean, you only have so much money in the NASA budget overall. So you're going to either take money from away from some other science mission, okay, some other science program, some other part of the budget that currently is funded, some certain amount that they were expecting to get, okay, or you just you know, take money out of human spaceflight, or you close the NASA center and use that funding to fund James Webb.
I was actually thinking, unrealistically, of course, that they might actually increase the NASA budget so that astrophysics had a higher budget, but that's not going to happen.
Well,
we know that
right now, when you've got, as Randy said, you know, members of the Tea Party and others around the country who are genuinely worried about how much money the federal government is spending.
Not going to happen, yeah.
It's just not likely to happen. So, it's not like people didn't say that James Webb was going to be a problem. I mean, James Webb has been out of control as a program for years. A lot of the behaviors that we've been witnessing on James Webb are problems that we had at the Johnson Space Center on Space Station. So, where they just didn't want to apply cost discipline to the program. They didn't want to tell the contractor no. They didn't want to tell, you know, the instrument makers, no, you can't have extra time or extra money. And they weren't willing to cancel any part of it. And because they weren't willing to exercise discipline, it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and taking longer and longer and longer. And so now it may not fly until sometime next decade, and could cost over $8 billion. That's a lot for a space science mission. Even, you know, by the kinds of large missions we've done historically, that's pretty expensive.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll let somebody else get on now.
Thank you, Marshall.
All right, bye.
I'm sorry, his name was Marshall, not Randy. I was
Well, Randy that. is a guy who sent in the email in the other section from St. Louis wondering if Congress was that stupid to not connect the financial dots.
Yeah.
You know, and so...
And the answer to that question was, of course they are.
Where do we go from here? You know...
And the one thing we haven't talked much about is commercial crew. I mean, we talked a little bit about the contracting method. People need to understand that the fight right now over what kind of heavy lift system we're going to have is a very important fight, and it's a fight that I'm working hard on in Washington for both my clients and pro bono, because I care about exploration and care about, you know, our space program. But if we don't have commercial crew fully funded, or funded a lot more than it's funded right now, we're not going to have U.S. human spaceflight.
Well, and they're cutting it from 800 to 300 million, something
well,
like that.
Well, the request was 850 million, and the the appropriations bill in the House level funds it at last year's funding of 312, which is a 65 to 70% cut from the requested level. So, obviously, I'm not one of those people that believes that just because a president requests an amount of money, that means that that's how much you're supposed to get. But the fact is if we want to fully utilize the space station, if we want to actually do science on it, if we really believe that there's a reason we've just spent $100 billion building it, and that it is the first human city in space, and that there is research that we can do there, not only on microgravity, but also on new technologies that we can use as part of exploration, then we should aggressively develop a capability to more affordably access it with researchers who can go up there and actually increase the crew size beyond six. Because remember, space station was designed initially to support seven. We could increase the crew size if we had more crew rescue capability and more better ways of getting people and stuff up there. And if we fund commercial crew enough, we can have multiple U.S. companies flying astronauts to the space station in less than 4 years. But if we don't fund it, then we'll all be just talking about it while we continue to spend roughly 10 times as much as we are on commercial crew on the combination of Orion and the Space Launch System. And that's never going to launch astronauts to the space station. I mean, by NASA's own estimate, it won't fly an astronaut until 2021. And while I don't think we're going to deorbit the space station in 2021, we haven't made the policy decision yet to keep it going beyond 2020. So it's a long time to depend upon our partners, the Russians, for buying services. The price of seats has gone up every year dramatically. We're now at something like $63 million per seat. They're going to go up even more next year because now we don't have the shuttle as an alternative means of taking people up there. And we'll be totally dependent on Russians for flying people to and from the space station. If you believe in human spaceflight, if you believe in an American approach to space that does involve the private sector, then we simply have to get Congress to agree to fund commercial crew.
So
now, I would argue that we don't just need commercial crew for the future of human spaceflight. We also need to start investing in technology like propellant transfer and storage so that we can build an interplanetary highway, a refueling station. So that means we don't have to have the very biggest launch vehicle to explore Mars. I want to explore Mars, but I don't want to wait for the most expensive launch vehicle possible before we send humans to an asteroid or humans to Mars. I'd like to use whatever launch vehicles we can afford to use and use propellant transfer and storage to make it possible to launch, spacecraft without all of their fuel at the same time. And then they gas up in LEO and gas up at L1 and go on.
For the House to cut roughly two-thirds of the commercial crew budget, what is their expected outcome after the cut, or does their wisdom allow them to continue to consider an expected outcome?
I think their concern is that they have too many things that they need to fund and not enough money. And I actually am something of a fan of Chairman Wolf in that I think he really does want America to have there's one aerospace company based in his district, okay, Orbital Sciences Corporation. But there's and no NASA centers. There is Langley and Wallops in Virginia, but they're on the other side of the state. Frank Wolf isn't your normal congressman. He doesn't do things just for parochial, constituent reasons. And my sense is that he really wants America to have a space program, and he's willing to try commercial, he's willing to try technology, he's willing to try a variety of things. But right now, the political pressure from the
companies, and we know their names, is to fund Orion and fund the Space Launch System. And we citizens who want to have an open frontier in space, you know, we need to call our congressmen, we need to call our senators, and say, we want you to actively, I mean, you may not be a member of the Appropriations Committee. That doesn't matter. I want you, my congressman, to contact whoever is your closest friend on the Appropriations Committee and tell them that your constituents care about commercial crew. You can't just say, vote for commercial crew, because they may or may not even get an opportunity to do that ever on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate. You know, there may or may not be a floor amendment that somebody offers to try to increase commercial crew funding, in which case hopefully they would accede to your request and vote for an increase. You've got to ask them to actually go do something, to actually represent you actively by going and talking to their colleagues and saying, this is an important issue. This is really important to people in my district, and I don't have maybe an aerospace company or a NASA center in my district. This is important because taxpayers think this is important to invest money in. So, you know, there's an opportunity for listeners of this show, you know, right now and over the next few weeks to go back and go, you know, your congressman is in your district. You know, they're at home. They're going to state fairs and county fairs, and they're holding town halls and things like that. And you can, you know, and some of them are on vacation, but they are actually available for a change for citizens to go talk to them. And so I would strongly request everyone, you know, go talk to your member of Congress. Now, I know it, you know, can seem like you have to take a really hot shower afterwards, but go talk to your member of Congress and say, listen, you know, we are spending an awful lot of money in space right now. If we just spent a little bit of it on, not more money total, just a little bit, a larger fraction of what we're spending now, on effectively privatizing, you know, the launch of astronauts to and from the space station, we'll be able to save money, we'll be able to do more with the space station, we'll get a higher return on investment on what we've already spent, we'll lower the cost of access to space, we'll create new jobs, and they'll be partly commercial jobs because they'll have commercial customers as well as the government customer, and so the jobs will be more sustainable than jobs that are just beholden to NASA contracts, and we'll start to open the space frontier. Because people will go up to a Bigelow space station or some other commercial space station, as well as ISS, and they'll come up with a new product or service, and they'll create more jobs. And that's really the vision of America. That's, you know, a bubbling, chaotic, free-based, you know, freedom-based frontier where new cultural and new economic and new scientific possibilities are discovered when we go and live in a new place. And, you know, that's why I'm in this. I'm not in this because I'm a rocket scientist, because I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm in this because I want us to have a frontier. I want us to be free. And, you know, ultimately, right now, the fight is commercial crew and new technology. Can we increase funding for commercial crew and increase the possible funding for NASA space technology programs so that we can open up the solar system to humanity? That's what it's about.
Is there a substantial difference in importance on space policy between the House and the Senate?
I think for a lot of reasons, the Senate is a little bit more concerned with, you know, the Authorization Act that was passed last year and trying to preserve it as much as possible. But I will say that the Senate has also been open in the form of these letters from, you know, Senator Feinstein and Boxer, Senator Murray and others in advocating for competition on SLS. So, you know, I think there's a lot of good ideas coming out of the Senate as well as perhaps some unfundable ideas coming out of the Senate or unsustainable ideas coming out of the Senate. The House, I am a creature of the House. That's where I spent all my time when I worked on the Hill. My two tours of duty were both in the House of Representatives, first from 81 to 83, and then from 95 to 2000. And
I'm very much akin to the rhythms and the democratic impulses, small d democratic impulses of the House. But I don't understand the House right now because too many members of the House seem to just want to just beat up on Obama or just, you know, beat up on NASA, and I'm not sure what they're for. It's a concern, especially the Science Committee. It's a real concern to me.
John Hunt has a follow-up email to his phone call. Let me find it. Here it is. He's in Atlanta. What perhaps was missed in Jim's response to my comments was my point that SLS is going to be stretched at best, like the C-17 and the V-22 programs were. The core effort is the crew vehicle. It can be launched with an EELV to LEO in order to support the ISS. This has been my consistent position on my calls for the last year or so. I just think that having a live SLS program is important rather than abandoning it completely. So he's pushing for the crew vehicle. So where do you come down?
Well, I think that the Obama administration made a mistake when they announced their program in February of 2010 to not include Orion. They should have included Orion and they eventually added Orion back, although in a fairly clumsy way that I don't think was totally effective. It certainly wasn't totally effective at bringing Lockheed Martin sort of into the family of companies supporting the president's agenda. But, you know, they made the mistake. You know, arguably they were punished for it. And it is now part of the program. And I think, you know, everyone agrees, or almost everyone agrees, that we need to have a spaceship. That if NASA is going to explore in a NASA way, is going to have a NASA spaceship to explore with. Now, I have very good friends who think we should be attacking Orion just as much as we're criticizing or raising questions about SLS. Fine. You know, I believe that SLS is a greater danger, or, you know, an SLS that has no limitations on it, has no competition in it, is literally just about keeping shuttle contractors, you know, employed, is worse than Orion. Even as expensive as Orion is and as perhaps over-designed as it is and as problematic as it may be long-term, I think Orion for a while is a very valid thing for NASA to have. We haven't – you're asking a lot to say to NASA, not only do we want you to believe that companies can develop spaceships that can go to low Earth orbit, but we actually also want you to believe that those commercial companies will be able to turn those spaceships into vehicles that can safely operate for months or years flying back and forth, you know, to Mars or to an asteroid on the main belt, okay? That's harder for NASA to believe. And I'm for not wishing too many impossible things when I get up in the morning. I want to wish that we can constrain and reform the SLS program through competition and through commercial approaches and through new technology while we allow a somewhat reformed Orion program to go forward. I don't believe that NASA is going to accept or that members of Congress will accept that there will be a NASA human spaceflight program if they aren't going to have a spaceship flying. It may be symbolic and rhetorical as opposed to substantive, but I still believe it, and I have to deal with it. I mean, it is a political reality.
So the budget is supposed to be finished by, you know, in September. Do you see any chance of that?
Oh, please.
I guess that means no, right?
I didn't know your show was about science fiction, David. No, it's not going to be finished in time. There will be a continuing resolution. Exactly, you know, what form that resolution takes and whether or not they will simply continue the current approach of last year's continuing resolution, or whether they'll, you know, start to make changes, hopefully to continue to allow the new direction to go forward. Your guess is as good as mine. I just don't know.
Bill in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by email, and he says, David, your guest is talking to a pro-space audience. While some differences might exist among the audience members as to which program they like or dislike, they're pro-space and they understand the value of space. Let's transport Jim into a campaign speech by an active candidate for president or senator or whatever you want to choose, and it's all general public, no space enthusiast in there. And they're faced with horrible, horrible problems due to the economy, some more than others, and some survival are really threatened. So now, justify why we should spend anything on human spaceflight rather than on helping people in need and trying to fix this economy.
Well, I would go, frankly, to the words of my former boss, who I thought spoke fairly eloquently about this at the debate in New Hampshire a few months ago. Newt said that he was not taking a position against space. He was taking a position against a centrally bureaucratic way of going about spaceflight, by saying he didn't want to have NASA run all of human spaceflight. He wanted there to be a more decentralized, more commercial approach. And I can absolutely make the argument publicly at a venue of your choice to say, right now what we have is a space program that is not about actually creating private sector jobs. We have a space program that is about creating jobs that are basically extensions of the federal government, that are not, in fact, commercial jobs with the potential of growing beyond what the government can pay them to do. And therefore, it's not an economically beneficial approach. And we need to have an economically beneficial approach. It's arguably not even an American-style approach, and we need to have such an approach. And I think there would be genuine support for substantial reform of how we do space in this country, given the financial crisis or economic crisis we're in.
But
now, as far as arguing about spending money on space or not, I think the argument has to be, if we're going to spend money on space, clearly we should spend it in a way that's going to benefit the economy and actually create industries and not just have a government program. And I think there would be support for that.
Including human spaceflight?
Absolutely. I don't see why, if either we believe that our nation has frontiers, and I'm not for saying to the American people, you should be taxed so that a few special people called astronauts get to go into space and explore a frontier that you will never get to participate in, and your children will never get to participate in, because they're special, okay, and they're astronauts. I'm not for that. What I'm for is saying to the American people, if we plant seed corn, and it's real seed corn, it's not just stuff that we call seed corn because it's spending we'd like as opposed to spending we don't like, I would argue that we can get the American people to agree that a reasonable amount of investing in the future makes sense. But it really has to be an investment. It can't just be spending. It can't just be putting money into things we've been doing, i.e. keeping shuttle contractors going, just because we've been doing it. And using the rhetoric of space, the rhetoric of a frontier, the rhetoric of exploring the solar system to argue for what is basically just, you know, craven funding for things that we want to keep funding.
So if you were placing a line of bets in Las Vegas on what will happen.
Oh, please.
Where do you think we're going to come out on
this? Oh, I wanted to ask, who was the guy from Texas that called in or wrote in?
Marshall called in.
Okay, I'd love to know what Randy thinks of Mr. Perry.
you know.
Of Marshall, you mean, not Randy.
Yeah,
Randy's in St. Louis.
Right.
Okay, Marshall, if you're still listening, call back and or email.
Or email us and tell us. But I, you know, I don't know who's going to be the nominee. I do think that the economy is perhaps weak enough that the president won't be reelected. As far as space policy is concerned, I'm actually kind of worried about that because...
Nobody seems to talk it up, do they? Other than Newt is the only one who really understands it.
I've heard, you know, that Perry has made a few negative comments about... I mean, I've heard so many Republican politicians say such palpable nonsense about space policy over the last year and a half, 2 years, that... I tremble for my country.
Well,
I really worry that we could see sort of a knee-jerk reactionary going back to the program or the kind of approach that got us into this trouble in the first place.
Well, I have heard Republican talk show hosts attacking Obama for his cancellation of shuttle, which he did not do, and I'm not an Obama fan, as you know, and as the listeners know. But furthermore, they don't seem to know the difference between DOD and NASA because they say, you know, the retiring of the shuttle and the canceling of Constellation and all of this is going to hurt our ICBM force. And I'm thinking, you know, I could pick up the phone and try to call in and clear the air, but why bother? Because I probably wouldn't get on the air.
Well, I wish you would
it's absurd.
But the talking point you're quoting there is a talking point from ATK and its supporters in Congress. That is an explicit effort by ATK and some of its supporters in Congress to argue that if we aren't flying solid rocket motors in our human spaceflight systems, that is going to hurt our ICBM force. Now, for your listeners' benefit, let me tell you exactly what the limited linkage is. Both kinds of solid rocket motors use ammonium perchlorate. There is one producer of ammonium perchlorate in this country. It's a company called American Pacific, and it's based, not so surprisingly, in Nevada, the home of the majority leader who just signed Senator Hatch's silly letter. Okay?
Yeah.
The fact is that because NASA buys a lot of ammonium perchlorate for its solid rocket motors, the production capacity of ammonium perchlorate is high and the unit cost is low. When we stop making solid rocket boosters for NASA, the cost of ammonium perchlorate will go up, and therefore the cost of solids will go up.
To the Air Force.
To the Air Force.
Right.
Okay?
It's a dual-use product.
ICBMs are not segmented solid rocket motors. ATK builds its ICBM motors at a place called Magna, Utah, which is actually just outside of Salt Lake City. It builds its solid rocket motors for the shuttle at Promontory. Now, in a rational world, what the Department of Defense and NASA would do is they say, we want there to be solid rocket motors as strap-ons for launch vehicles that can afford them at this, you know, in terms of EELVs and other vehicles that might use smaller solids, and we want there to be ICBMs. We are going to pay ATK the cost of moving the stuff at Magna from Magna to Promontory, and we are going to help them consolidate their infrastructure and then sell off all that valuable real estate right outside of Salt Lake City, so that they don't have to spend money maintaining two factories for two customers. Instead, they will have one factory for multiple customers. And, oh, by the way, they'll just make regular single-pore solids. They won't make segmented solids because nobody else needs them. But we don't live in a rational world. So instead, ATK has to run around saying, buy our solid rocket motors, or there won't be any effective subsidy of ICBM prices from NASA's business. Well, do we want NASA to be subsidizing the Defense Department's budget? I don't think so. I don't think that's a reason, a primary reason we should be making space policy. That's why, by the way, I don't argue for using EELV for exploration because it will lower costs to the Defense Department. It will lower the cost of the Defense Department, but much more importantly, it will lower the cost of exploration to NASA. And I'm focused on NASA and solving its problems. And therefore, I want NASA to use EELVs or its derivatives and Falcons and its derivatives for exploration because other government agencies and the private sector are already buying them, which means NASA doesn't have to pay all of its their fixed costs for EELVs, to buy EELVs and to buy Falcons. That's the magic of using a multi-use tool, is you don't have to pay for the whole thing. But when NASA says, we have to have our kind of tool, our kind of way, and oh, by the way, all of our friends that were astronauts that went to work for ATK or went to work for other companies that are involved in human spaceflight, you know, that make solid rocket motors, we should be doing that. I'm sorry. It's just, you know, that's not a reason to make a technical choice.
But Aerojet General makes, you know, SRBs for Atlas and Delta.
Right. Well, they make the SRBs for the Atlas, and ATK makes the Atlas SRBs for the Delta.
For the okay. So they're making them for the, I don't know, they probably buy the chemical for it from the same place you mentioned.
And prices have gone up. And prices are going to go up generally because right now we're not making any ICBMs. I mean, the way we make ICBMs is every 20 or 30 years, we spend a bunch of money to build a bunch of ICBMs. And then we go for 10 or 15 years and we don't make any, or we make a very small number of ICBMs.
Well, we're
but
probably...
we sustain refresh all of the motors in the ICBMs like every 20 or 25 years.
You have a caller, so and I know your voice is falling out, so let's...
I'm drinking something so that it won't.
Okay, so we're coming up to a two-hour show anyway. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Marshall. Somebody asked me a question?
Yes. What are your thoughts
of Governor Perry?
Of Governor Perry and his space ideas and everything.
Oh, well, one of the things, he's been governor for like 10 years, and the whole play at the Iowa straw poll, and even his comment about Bernanke is so scripted. It's down to the hand gestures. And watching the Sunday morning political talking heads, they're all, you know, indignant about, gee, what he said. And I'm just sitting here giggling because they're playing right into his hands. I think Perry is a wonderful political tactician. But to bet on him to... be a major push for space projects of any kind, you better make sure that you have the political backing because he will turn with the wind and go in the direction that the political winds are going to blow him. And he will do it while smiling, tipping his hat, and winking at you, and you'll feel good about it even though he's, you know, pulling the rug out from underneath you.
Jim?
That's really funny. That's classic. Well, that could be good news or bad news. I don't know, David. That could, you know, we'll have to see.
Well, I'm a nonprofit, so I can't really do partisan politics, but I'll just say, I mean, listeners know I'm an independent conservative, and I'm not supportive of the administration under any circumstances, and I would vote anybody to get him out, although I'm really unhappy with our choices, and I'm very unhappy that space still can't rise to at least some kind of a top 10 item among people. And if we believe that space is as valuable and important for our future as it is, damn it, it's worth the investment. Even in hard times, you know, and
okay,
I was in...
but okay, let me take issue with that though, okay? I agree with you that it's important, okay? If we take an approach to space.
No, I agree. I mean, you cut me off. I mean, you can't just throw money at a problem and hope for super-duper results. You've got to have a constructive policy program that uses the money to the best advantage. And, I mean, I'd love to see a triple the NASA budget, but not for them to go do whatever they want to do the way they do it. That'd be just pissing away three times what they're getting. So I agree with you. You have to use the money wisely and effectively, but even in down times, you should invest in your future.
If you don't plant seed corn, there won't be any corn.
Absolutely.
And I could toss in which project is the best piece of seed corn. Ooh.
All right,
is
so
that a political cut your throat with?
Marshall, before you take off, since we're asking about things, is the University of Texas going to have a decent football team? I'm not reading good things about them.
Well, the real question is, will the football conference last?
Well, yeah, we know the Big 8 or the Big 10 or the Big 12. We don't know what it is anymore. may disappear into the ether somehow, but going to be an interesting year for sure.
Particularly the OU-OSU game, the only major requirement to be considered an Okie.
Jim, anything else for Marshall?
No, that's it. That's great.
Okay, thanks for calling
Bye-bye.
Back, Marshall. So contact our members of Congress. Does it do any good to contact the White House or the science advisor?
No, I don't think that's necessary. I think the locus of the fight now is in the Congress, in the House and in the Senate, and calls to both the House and the Senate, ask your congressman and ask your two senators to engage with the Appropriations Committee to argue for full funding of commercial crew and as much funding as possible for space technology so that we can actually have an affordable space program, so that we can actually have a space program that will get America into space as opposed to just, keeping certain companies and certain projects going because they're a benefit. My argument about, the broader issue of how do we make space a bigger issue is, maybe instead of making it about the interests of a few states, we made it about the interests of the whole country. In other words, what if, and this is just a hypothetical example, and I'm not saying it's a perfect example at all, because it's not. What if we made the goal for NASA to have 100,000 people a year fly to orbit? Okay? Maybe that's a little high. Maybe 10,000 people a year to fly to orbit. How would NASA spend its money in order for 10,000 people a year to fly to orbit? Okay? It would spend its money very differently than it's spending its money right now. Now, you would think, well, if only 10,000 people are flying to orbit, you're not really directly impacting that many people. But you're changing the nature of the program from a program where a few people are flying into space to you're building an industry where eventually millions of people will fly into space. And because millions will fly, many, many more, tens of millions will have jobs and opportunities here on the ground doing things with and for that market of people going into space. And people aren't just going to go as tourists. They're going to go and try out new business ideas or new scientific experiments or new educational projects or new cultural projects, and we will literally invent the next wave of our society in space. Now, that's a very different program than what we have now. I would argue that kind of policy, that kind of approach, it's not just a matter of being efficient with your dollars, it's actually having a very different definition of what your business is, of what the purpose of the program is, okay? If you change the direction of the program towards that sort of goal, you would have a much more politically sustainable effort because it would benefit many, many more people. And people aren't stupid. They don't vote for things that aren't relevant to their lives. And a program that is, by all polling data shows,
a luxury. It is NASA is perceived as a luxury, as a nice thing we do to make ourselves feel good about being a top-tier country, not something we do that is an investment in the future. Because if it were an investment in the future, people would have some sense that it was paying off. Now, we'd like to have our fights about spinoffs, and we'd like to have our discussions about, well, it is an investment, you know, it is the future, but is it really? Is what we're doing in space now really designed to impact everyone, to truly open a frontier to human civilization?
Well,
or is it not? And I would argue it's not, and I would argue it should be.
I think on the science side, we're more in that category than on the human spaceflight side, for sure.
I would disagree, and the reason I would disagree is because in science, like in human spaceflight, we have set up these programs that, like the space station, you know, 15, 20 years ago, like James Webb, are too big to fail. And so we have these silly arguments about whether or not, you know, we're pro-science or not, based on whether or not we continue to shovel money at James Webb. But I would argue that that's as anti-science as just keeping shuttle contractors on the federal dole is anti-human spaceflight over the long term.
What should we be looking for over the next couple of months that would be key points to be observant about?
I think the key thing is to watch what Congress is doing on commercial crew and watch what happens, obviously, on the major issues associated with the architecture for human exploration. NASA is making some announcements soon that will invest more money in propellant depots. You know, we may see some news come out of NASA on that front, on some new studies that they've done in terms of how much cheaper it is to explore using propellant depots than if you just use new launch vehicles. The new heavy lift launch vehicles, and I'm hoping that we'll see this fight over competition in SLS and other things sort of morph into a new direction for SLS that is more evolutionary, more incremental, build it as we need it, and remains affordable, and is something that we can actually finish, as opposed to just another space transportation project that we start and then have to cancel.
If people who hear this on archives have a question or comment for you, can they email you? Do you give out your address?
Always. james.muncy@polyspace.com.
Any closing comments? We're up on 2 hours, and I think that's a good length.
I think it's fine, and I've always had fun talking to you and your listeners, and I would just encourage them, you know, reach out, talk to your member of Congress and your senators now, and over the fall, and make sure that they go in there and fight for your vision of what kind of space program we should have, and your desire for human spaceflight to be commercialized, and for ISS to really become that first city in space using things like commercial crew.
Is getting you back on quarterly too much because
no,
events?
I'm willing. Well, your listeners will tell you whether it's too much.
No, I'm thinking in terms of how fast things move in D.C. to keep us posted.
I would be glad to come in a quarter or even in 2 months, whatever you want.
Okay. I will send you the latest schedule and look forward to talking to you a couple more times this year.
Great.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it. And listeners, no show tomorrow. The head of the Human Factors Department at Florida Institute of Technology on Tuesday, Leroy Chow Friday morning, webinar on what we were talking about a little while ago with Josh Hopkins on Sunday, and then a Human Factors panel Monday evening. So it's going to be a strong Human Factors week on space medicine, all of that kind of stuff, starting Tuesday evening. And you don't want to miss those programs. Special thanks to Jim Muncy, as always, and thank you all for listening and participating. Goodbye from the Space Show.